loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, President Trump wraps up his European trip today, with the last stop being Helsinki. He called the European Union a foe, told British Prime Minister May to sue the EU. He said Boris Johnson would make a great prime minister of the UK, and he weighed in on the Nord Stream pipeline that will pipe Russian gas to Germany much more cheaply than any US alternative. Next, police in Chicago shot and killed a man on Saturday when he appeared to be reaching for a gun. Protests across the city became heated on Saturday night, and today the police released two body cam videos of the incident to try to calm the public. Then we continue our series called Stories from the National Museum of African American History and Culture, where Dr. Alice Bonner highlights some of the most important episodes in Black history. Today she focuses on John Brown's rebellion in Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. And then the White House yesterday ordered the State Department to seek direct negotiations with the Taliban in the hope of jumpstarting efforts to end the 17-year war there. The Taliban have said that they will only deal with the United States, but President Trump insists that the Afghan government also take part. And finally, we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, where we look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to President Trump's European trip. He wraps up that trip today, with the last stop being Helsinki, Finland. He called the European Union a foe, told British Prime Minister May to sue the EU. He said Boris Johnson would make a great prime minister of the UK, and he weighed in on the Nord Stream pipeline that will pipe Russian gas to Germany much more cheaply than any U.S. alternative. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh, the editor of thepolemicist.net, whose most recent piece is Sacrificing Gaza, the Great March of Zionist Hypocrisy. Jim, welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Jim, by all accounts, this trip was a disaster, but you'd never know it watching the news. He insulted his hosts repeatedly in the UK. He essentially threw Theresa May under the bus by basically endorsing Boris Johnson as the next leader of the Tory party and prime minister. And then when he came out of the summit today with Vladimir Putin, he said that poor relations were due to the US's inability to get along with anybody. So what do you make of this trip so far?
Oh, I think it's wonderful. Sorry. But what he's doing is, well, first of all, he's nuts and he's impulsive, and he says things that are 90% of the time crazy, but 10% of the time they're true. But he's just completely impolitic. He doesn't know how to deal with these issues, and he's off script all the time. But what is interesting to me is that, you know, he's demonstrating that the United States is an empire, and it pushes people around. He's doing it obviously and blatantly. He goes to Europe and says, hey, you guys are buying gas from Russia. We don't like that, you know, and you got to raise your defense spending. And this is what we want you to do. And this is, you know, and this is what I like. Now, those kind of orders were being issued behind the scenes and behind a veil of nice, mellifluous rhetoric previously. But he's just going off and bloviating and saying whatever he wants. And what are the Europeans going to do? Don't the Europeans follow American orders about to whom they can sell things and buy things and from whom they can buy things? Aren't they going to follow American orders about not buying oil from Iran? Are they going to try and raise their defense spending? They're putting the Europeans in the position of having to say, okay, we will obviously, in an obvious and blatant way, we will follow your orders, America, or not, or rebelling against it. I mean, it was classic. The NATO, Stoltenberg, the head of NATO, said, "Look, what we're doing in NATO is helping protect the United States power projection in the Middle East and Africa. That's what we're doing in NATO." I mean, they had to admit outright, you know, in order to kind of defend themselves, we're working for you. So, in a certain sense, Trump is revealing the problems and contradictions of empire in a way that's just too blatant. And, you know, the kinds of things he says, as I say, half of them are crazy and they're insulting and but it's also he's exercising the power that he feels he has because he's the president of the United States, which in some respects he does. And I just think it's completely out of the script.
I'm glad Jim made this point, because you know there's a lot of talk by progressive punditry that the American empire is fading, its power is eclipsed, it's blah blah blah, the rise of China, the emergence of Russia again, et cetera, et cetera. But here you have really the demonstration of American power, because no other leader could come to Europe and talk like Trump talked about the leadership in Europe, or when he went to UK about his host. They can't do it. George Galloway was our guest last week, and he said, we've never seen anything like it in Europe. It's like Tony Soprano marching through, giving everybody orders. By the way, some people on Facebook wrote back to me and said that Tony Soprano had some other qualities. But here's on the other side, the so-called liberals, and I think we just have to abandon the word liberal because it no longer has any meaning whatsoever. Because the liberals are more imperialist than the conservatives.
Yep.
But here you have articles like from Paul Krugman, a New York Times liberal economist who liberals love. He's writing about the fall of the American empire, and it's kind of a black and white picture of Donald Trump sort of walking away, sort of maybe into the horizon, American flags around him, that what Trump is doing is actually disrupting the American empire. I thought we thought empires were bad, but now apparently, according to Paul Krugman, the empire we didn't know we had was actually a good thing, and Donald Trump's conduct and his rhetoric is harming the empire. And so you have this weirdness. I mean, I just find it completely weird that the people who consider themselves liberal are attacking Donald Trump for having too much of a, quote, peace agenda, peace for Russia. Obviously, the peace with Germany or France or the UK isn't an issue. These countries are supplicants. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, this is the nature of their compliance, and what compliance puppets or whatever you want to call them are, is going to show up in what they do. As you say, they can't. Why don't they just say, get the hell out of here? You know, we're not going to do it yet. Oh, no, we'll try and do it. You know, and it's, what else can they do? We've been helping you project power. That's what NATO is about. You got to spend more money on NATO. What for? If they haven't seen the need to spend more money on NATO, why should they? Because we tell them to.
Let me ask you something, though, Jim. Let me ask you. You know, one of the dangers I think that Democrats have, or progressives have, is that we've underestimated this guy a number of times, and we've taken it on the chin because of it. Is there some kind of method to his madness? Is he outfoxing people on the left politically?
Well, that's a very low bar.
Yeah, well, true.
Yeah, the general point I would say about that is what he demonstrates again is the low level of American political culture.
Right.
And you know, and actually my latest article is about this issue in The New Yorker. It's called Fighting Fake News, The New Yorker Serves Up a Doozy, where this article in The New Yorker about that Obama's discovered after 6 years in office that the Israelis were taking over the West Bank because he found this little map. You know, like he didn't know it before. So, you know, and so you have this low level of American. So either that's true and he's an idiot, or it's not true and the people reading his article believe it and they're idiots. I mean, so you have this low level of American political culture. And in that context, what Donald Trump is, we've seen 1,000 of them, is the guy who comes in straight shoots. You know, he's not talking carefully. He's not parsing his words. He's just saying what he thinks. And everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people, that's very attractive to them. And it creates a huge problem for the establishment now. Because I got to say, these are central, NATO, Europe, these are central issues for the American empire that Paul Krugman now recognizes. And Donald Trump is disrupting them with this nonsense. And I think he's in danger of being taken out in a way that's more decisive and immediate and quicker than impeachment. And they'll blame it. They'll say the Russians poisoned them or whatever. But, you know, this is now getting to a point where they got to say, what the heck is going on here? Do you see the tweet from Brennan today saying,
oh, it was scandalous. You
know, he said, this is beyond high crimes and misdemeanors. Where are the patriots? Now, he's essentially calling for a coup.
Yeah. Basically, he is. In fact, I can read it to you. I have it right here in front of me. He says, Donald Trump's press conference performance in Helsinki rises to and exceeds the threshold of high crimes and misdemeanors. It was nothing short of treason. Not only were Trump's comments imbecilic, He is wholly in the pocket of Putin. Republican patriots, where are you?
Wow. Yeah, that's a call to arms. That's a call to arms.
It is. It is. And Democratic Twitter has been for the last 4 or 5 days. This is Russian hacking is equivalent to 9/11 and Pearl Harbor. I mean, this is insanity. This is, you know, saying we're at war with Russia. We got to treat Russia as an enemy. So when you start doing that, and then the president starts undermining that, what's the solution of that could satisfy people like Brennan? Because impeachment takes a long time, and impeachment is going to be devastating for the Republicans. No Republicans can vote to impeach Trump because the people who are hearing him like it, and they're going to say, you're just trying to overturn the election, which is true. And so how are they going to get rid of him?
Yeah.
Are they going to let him go?
Well, in the last couple of weeks, we've been quoting the Rasmussen study where 32% of all Americans believe that there will be another civil war in the United States in the next few years.
Insane. We're going to have to end it there, though, guys. We were joined by Jim Kavanaugh. Jim was in New York. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net, and his most recent piece is Sacrificing Gaza, the Great March of Zionist Hypocrisy. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Police in Chicago shot and killed a man on Saturday when he appeared to be reaching for a gun. Protests across the city became heated by Saturday night, and today the police released two body cam videos of the incident to try to calm the public. We're joined from Chicago by Kofi Adamola. He's an activist and organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement. Kofi, good to talk to you.
Thank you all for having me, as always.
Kofi, we're talking about the killing of Harith Augustus. Can you walk us through what happened on Saturday night?
Yeah. So they released the video cam footage, as you stated. But what we don't have with that footage is the audio. And what people don't understand is, unfortunately, the police have the discretion to turn their audio or video off at any time. Or even when they're both recording, they can release those things separately. So their narrative of approaching him because he was suspicious, you know, for whatever reasons, we don't know because we have no dialogue. So we don't know what was exchanged or said between them. But from the video, just seeing the sort of six officers surround him and then the woman officer who ended up shooting him, how she approached to grab him, it seemed like he was startled and scared. And he, you know, ran from them as he's running in between two cars. You know, we see her raising the gun towards him. And then another officer is in a police vehicle, which cuts him off. And it seems like because he's cut off by that vehicle, he kind of spins. And to me, I don't know if he's, you know, going to pull up his pants or, you know, secure his weapon or whatever the case may be. And I can't tell when she starts firing. That's the other problem. But either way, his gun isn't taken out of the holster, and he's shot about six or seven times. And then from what community was saying, they'd witnessed the entire thing. From their perspective, is that he wasn't trying to draw, first and foremost, and then two, when the community, you know, was originally saying something about it, CPD took his body, threw it in the back of another vehicle, and then quickly got the shooting officer off the scene as community started to pour out. So as word spread through social media about the shooting, activist organizers came out there. But more importantly, what we need to pay attention about this is this wasn't activist and organizer led. This was community led. So it was predominantly surrounding residents, people working that actually took to the streets and demanded answers. So when officers started to show up at about 100 deep and accost and attack the crowd, They were attacking people that lived in that community. They were attacking business owners and people that have stake in that community. And one of the people that was out there that night is William Calloway. Not only did he run for state representative for a political position in that community, but he's also the young man that first got the Laquan McDonald video in the public's eye and got them, you know, work with the Invisible Institute to get it legally released. So this was an important moment because the community was absolutely fed up, because this is the second shooting by police over in that neighborhood within the past couple of weeks. And the fact that they, you know, were so aggressive right after just 1 week trying to look publicly good by having Superintendent Eddie march with Father Flager in the so-called shutdown of the Dan Ryan, where they were marching, you know, to bring awareness to gun violence in Chicago. That was a publicity win for the Chicago Police Department, because they had just came off, you know, being exposed as once again being a murderous organization after they killed Maurice Granton in cold blood by shooting him in the back as he was running away from them. So they, you know, participated in helping to make sure that that march went smoothly and, you know, had their superintendent front and center to make it seem like he actually cared about, you know, what was happening in Chicago as far as gun violence, to then have the police department literally beating people with batons, throwing people to the ground. And this is including women and young girls, and then arbitrarily, you know, arresting four people, but then letting them go because they know they didn't have any real, you know, grounds to hold them for. So that's led to sustained protests. The protests happened last night, where people were out to about 1 a.m. And then there's a bigger protest that Black Lives Matter Chicago and the Chicago Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression is hosting tonight, because we have real concrete demands. Chicago has been working on a consent decree with the Campbell lawsuit, and Chicago has been working on complete community control of the police, and that's called the CPAC, the Civilian Police Accountability Council, which would have democratically elected community members from all the 22 precincts that would have oversight around police accountability, hiring, firing, and just really giving community control over the police, because we know it's about power. And if they aren't beholden to the community, then they will behave the way that they're behaving, which is seeing Black and brown people as disposable and then getting away with murder time and time again and using whatever narrative they have to justify killing us, which, you know, has been a pattern in Chicago for at least the last year, where there's been shooting after shooting by police, and they say that the victim had a gun and that justified them killing that person. And we still haven't gotten through the Laquan McDonald trial.
Yeah,
so we're
right.
Still waiting to get justice on that.
We're joined from Chicago by Kofi Adamola. Kofi is an activist and organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, all across the country, John, people are encouraged to have weapons. I mean, you know, in white communities in particular, all over the country, it's the cherished Second Amendment. Harith Augustus is dead today, shot down by the police. And you can see the video. I mean, he's there on the sidewalk. They surround him. They start grabbing at him. He starts to run, and he's dead. He's shot multiple times. Kofi, who is Harith Augustus?
He was a father. He was a pillar in the community. He was a barber. And if anybody knows about Black culture, and specifically in the Black community, the barbershop is a place where you come to socialize, not just get a haircut, but to socialize, to talk politics, to talk entertainment, to laugh, have a good time. But more importantly, to feel like a safe space, to decompress, and just have a good time. So people in the community were saying that, you know, he played an active role in, ironically, de-escalating a lot of potential violence that can occur, and being a negotiator, and, you know, just bringing positive energy to that neighborhood. So there's going to be, you know, a presence felt, a loss felt, you know, not just for his immediate family, but for his coworkers, and then there's that surrounding community, which is a very tight-knit community. And that's why so many people were out there demanding justice, because they took someone's life that should still be here. And again, that's a part of it, that the police don't know how to de-escalate situations. They come immediately criminalizing you. You know, just the language and the words they use to even depict him, to justify killing him, is this narrative we see over and over again, from Trayvon Martin to Mike Brown to Joshua Beall in Chicago and Laquan McDonald, up until they released the tape. And even after the tape, you know, they still try to, you know, paint this picture that he was a thug and someone deserving of the violence perpetrated against him. So I'm glad you all are giving people like myself opportunity to tell this counter narrative that, you know, people who are important to the community, that are loving, that are caring, their lives are being needlessly taken, because blackness is criminalized and we're seen as a threat. And we are constantly battling this constant narrative that pathologizes us as if we are inherently criminal and deserving of the violence perpetrated against our bodies, because we are dealing with intercommunal violence, right? Because we're dealing with poverty and all these other factors and all these other, you know, manifestations of violence, that they think that the state should come in a very violent manner to control us. And that's very problematic. And that's what we're trying to get. We're trying to, you know, stop that institutional violence and reclaim power and control so we can decide and have healthy, prosperous lives. But we can't do that when the police continue to intervene and take us.
Kofi, I was surprised. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I was surprised at how the CPD released this video. You know, they made a big deal about
they
coming
edited
out.
It.
That's exactly the point I was going to make. They edited this thing. They stopped it. They paused it. So it looks like he's reaching for this gun. As you said, he may not have ever been reaching for a gun.
Why would he? I mean,
why would he? He's
surrounded by police officers. Exactly. They stop him on the street. He's a barber. He's a father. He's an anchor in the community.
Exactly.
Yeah. And now the cops again have edited a video to criminalize mm-hmm. the victim, which is what they always do. Always.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Gareth Augustus, 37 years old, barber, father. He's dead today.
Yeah.
And the people, the community, as Kofi is saying, are the people are in the streets. Kofi, 30 seconds left. You get the last word.
Well, just with the release, we're still ironically demanding the release of the murder of Maurice Granton Jr. Maurice was shot in the back while running away from police almost a month ago now. And we still haven't gotten a video for that. So you all just said it best. They use it as propaganda to justify murdering us, and that has to stop. So Chicago Alliance and Black Lives Matter, Good Kids, Mad City, and a bunch of other people will be out there supporting communities today, continuing to demand justice for him. And the fight will continue.
Yeah, we are out of time. That was the voice of Kofi Adamola. He joined us from Chicago. He's an activist and organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
We continue our series called Stories from the National Museum of African American History and Culture, where Dr. Alice Bonner highlights some of the most important episodes in Black history. Dr. Bonner joins us here in the studio. She's a volunteer docent at the newly opened National Museum of African American History and Culture. She's a retired professor at the Philip Merrill College of Journalism at the University of Maryland and a longtime journalist at the Washington Post. She wrote her dissertation on Chapter 15 of the Kernel Report, focusing on the press. Dr. Bonner, welcome back.
Thank you.
We like to try to prepare for these segments by coming up with a list of topics, but the stories that you have are so rich and so detailed and so important to this country's history that it's almost impossible to follow one of these lists that we create. Today, I'd like to, though, ask you about one of the most interesting topics for me personally, and that's the story of John Brown. Every school child knows the basics of the story of John Brown, but I think what almost no Americans know was the role of African Americans around John Brown and in his circle.
Yes, and thankfully, Eugene Meyer has now documented the five critical members of that war, that army that John Brown had amassed in order to go to war against the United States government, or actually against slavery. He was, as was his forebear, in a way, Nat Turner in Southampton County, Virginia, rooted in religion as the reason that slavery was an abomination on this country, and that it was worth shedding blood. John Brown had shed blood out in the Midwest against slavery in Kansas, as we know, and he was preparing to go to war. He wouldn't have dreamed of doing this without the inclusion of African Americans who had the most at stake. And one of the most compelling aspects of this book, which is titled Five for Freedom, is that Gene Meyer tells how John Brown organized to make this assault on the institution of slavery in what was then Western Virginia, in the town of Harper's Ferry, distinguished by the fact that it was a gun factory town for the United States government. The armory there was to be attacked as a place to not only arm the people who were enslaved in that part of Virginia, which of course later became the state of West Virginia when Virginia seceded from the Union, but it was also at that point a place where slavery was a bit different because of the terrain and because of the unfolding of slavery in the region of the state away from the coast where it originated. It was not nearly as agricultural, et cetera. And it's a story that would make a brilliant Hollywood movie in the way that Meyer has told it with the characters. But these five men have not been so clearly identified and put together as a roster among the 20 or so people who participated. In the same vein, I have to say that Eugene Meyer did incorporate the stories of some critical women to this undertaking that other books have not done.
That's the voice of Dr. Ellis Bonner. She joins us in studio for this segment on the untold stories for the American people, but stories that are included at the National Museum of African American History and Culture, where Dr. Bonner is a volunteer docent. Dr. Bonner, yeah, we have John Brown. I mean, again, John Brown was vilified after...
Oh, yeah, arch-criminal.
Again, starting in the 1890s, you know, John Brown's Body was the song that, you know, inspired Unionist troops and abolitionist troops and people, black and white, who were fighting against slavery and racism. But then again, as that counter-revolution took over in 1890s, where the South ideologically won the Civil War, John Brown became vilified. Even when you go to Harper's Ferry, not far from here, the original stuff in that museum was pretty awful, actually.
Yes, but it did, I have to say, in later years, the National Park Service did incorporate this story, but it was very narrowly told of these five men and the women. One of the things that's little known is that two teenage women ran the household where John Brown's core army hid out near Harper's Ferry for a whole season, waiting to get the war underway. And people do not know much about a meeting in Chatham, Ontario, Canada, where a woman journalist, Mary Ann Shad Carey, who died and is buried in Washington, D.C., enabled a constitutional convention. Brown didn't have in mind just to run out and kill a bunch of slave owners. He had in mind that there would be created, and he had detailed plans for the creation of a nation of former slaves with a constitution, with all the things that would be essential to having their own land and their own government and their own art. And so he incited a good deal of excitement among Osborne Perry Anderson, the only black soldier in John Brown's army to survive the raid on Harper's Ferry.
And let me just say a word or two about Osborne Perry Anderson. He was born a free man in Chester, Pennsylvania. And I believe by the late 1840s, he had moved to Chatham in Canada, where you're mentioning, and he became a printer. He became he ran a print shop, and that was extremely important for the abolitionist movement. And later, Osborne Perry Anderson, a free black man who joined John Brown in this revolution that they tried in 1859, starting in Harper's Ferry, he escaped. He was one of the few who lived. And he wrote an account, which is now a pamphlet. You can get the pamphlet if you go online and look for it. A Voice from Harper's Ferry and Later Life by Osborne Perry Anderson. An amazing story.
Actually, it was published not too long after, so that gives us a bit more trust in his account, because there are so many countervailing accounts of what happened there and why. So he, among others, in this Five for Freedom were John Anthony Copeland, who was executed, as was John Brown, at Charlestown, as it was then called, West Virginia. He was born free, too, and he attended Oberlin College, the first American university that admitted black people in Ohio. Shields Green was a third person, and he was a runaway from Charleston. You know, Charleston was such a hot center of American slavery. It was the place where most the largest number of Africans were brought in. They had a peculiar kind of African slavery in Charleston and in South Carolina because of the climate there and because of the nature of the agriculture of rice and indigo, et cetera. And we know that he had made his way as a runaway to Rochester, New York, where he actually lived with Frederick Douglass, who, along with Brown, are at the top of the list of American abolitionists, many others as well, but they are the names that come immediately to mind. And he traveled with Frederick Douglass to Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, where John Brown had invited, during the planning, Frederick Douglass to come and join the raid. Douglass demurred, and he gave Shields Green the choice. Green was, we believe, born in Africa, and he had been called the emperor because he claimed to be of African royalty, and perhaps he was. And Douglass went back to Rochester, where he had much to keep him busy, and Shields Green went on to his death along with John Brown. We had the fourth of the five was Lewis Sheridan Leary, who was related to Copeland by marriage, and he was killed at Harper's Ferry when the raid was put down. And finally, a blacksmith named Dangerfield Newby, who was the son of a white man, which was so common. We make much of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings without taking into account that there was nothing extraordinary about a slave family fathered by a white man, much less a president. Most of our early presidents leading up to the Civil War were slave owners, and not exactly small slave owners, owners, beginning with George Washington. And so Newby was very handy to the raid and to the preparation for it, because, as you probably know, they were making pikes in case they had more slave volunteers in Western Virginia than they had guns. Now, John Brown had raised a lot of money, and he purchased quite a few arms, but he also, they spent that season holed up in a farmhouse nearby making pikes, poles with bayonets, so to speak, on the end of them. Yes, spears, because arms would be needed. One of the things that has disappeared into this history of John Brown's raid is the extent to how much the local enslaved people were prepared and eager to join his raid. Naturally, when the raid did not succeed, they declined to confess their eagerness to join the army or the resistance
to
slavery.
As all oppressed people do. I mean, if you can fight and win and be through your own heroism and the heroism of your colleagues and your sisters and your brothers and your comrades, if you can win, yes, but if the insurrection is defeated, of course people are going to say, no, I'm just a person who happens to be close by.
Yes. And of course, Virginia, being the first of southern states, the population there and the people who wrote the story and taught the story of John Brown's raid and vilified this abolitionist, rewrote that history, and they claimed that the slaves were so happy in Western Virginia that they wouldn't dare have taken up arms against slaveholders. And by the way, one of the major characters in this story, as Meyer has told it, is a grandnephew of George Washington, who some of his people that he owned were prepared to join John Brown's army, and they participated in an actual kidnapping of Louis Washington to further John Brown's cause before it failed. And so there is no absolute evidence that there was any timidity or preference for remaining enslaved, but it's another one of those stories, such as the larger story of the Underground Railroad, that we will never know the full extent of.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it right there. We're completely out of time, John. We were joined by Dr. Alice Bonner.
She joined us here in the studio, Brian. She is a volunteer docent at the newly opened National Museum of African American History and Culture. She's a retired professor at the Philip Merrill College of Journalism at the University of Maryland and a longtime journalist at the Washington Post. She wrote her dissertation on Chapter 15 of the Kerner Report, which focused on the press. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The White House yesterday ordered the State Department to seek direct negotiations with the Taliban in the hope of jump-starting efforts to end the 17-year war there. The Taliban have said that they will only speak with the United States, but President Trump insists that the Afghan government also take part. We're joined from Syracuse, New York by Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And Kathy is also a frequent visitor to Afghanistan. Kathy, welcome back.
Well, thank you.
Kathy, we've seen stories like this before, where the U.S. was going to engage directly with the Taliban. In fact, meetings were held several years ago in Doha, I believe it was, and we've met through intermediaries as well. So why is this situation any different from previous attempts?
Well, of course, there aren't any guarantees. You know, the war in Afghanistan has gone on for such a long time, with increasing control of Afghanistan being exercised by the Taliban, so that, you know, it's hard to imagine that the United States could ever leave Afghanistan and declare that somehow it had done an honorable or a worthwhile thing there. And there are repeated Special Inspector General in Afghanistan reconstruction reports that detail the corruption and the shoddiness of any efforts to try to repair what's gone wrong, terribly wrong, in Afghanistan. The civilian deaths reported by the United Nations, I believe 1,682 civilians killed since January of this year, are at a record high. And so in spite of the fact that weapon-making companies are profiting regularly from the United States war in Afghanistan, you know, they can keep on trying out new weapons, selling new weapons, and what will they do with all those weapons if they don't have wars? In spite of that, I think that it's increasingly difficult to persuade the U.S. public that there's anything worthwhile happening through U.S. pursuit of war in Afghanistan.
I noticed in a New York Times report today that the government controls 229 of Afghanistan's 407 districts. The Taliban controls 59. The remaining 119 districts are contested. I think that sounds awfully optimistic. And I think that it's these continuing Taliban advances, especially in the most populated districts, especially in southern Afghanistan, Helmand province, for example, or Kandahar province, that has pushed the United States to the table. The U.S. keeps saying that it wants an Afghan-led, Afghan-owned solution. We've not seen anything like that possible in the past. Do you think it is possible, if the Taliban acquiesce to U.S. demands, that the Afghan government take place in these negotiations?
Well, I think the Afghan government is compromised by its connection to various warlords. I mean, the Ashraf Ghani took on a warlord named Dostum as a vice president of Afghanistan. The warlords themselves are fighting with each other. I think that control of Afghanistan by various warlords is almost approaching 100% of the country. And so the United States is one among many contesting warlords. Certainly the United States is the best equipped with weapons, and it has the most money that it can rely on. It seems to me that were there to be anything approaching a better solution for Afghanistan, the United States would have to say, honestly, we're sorry. We're sorry for the destruction we've caused, and we want to pay reparations, and we want those reparations to go as directly to communities all across Afghanistan as possible. And to enable that, we are not going to rely on the United States military or the United States Aid for International Development or the groups that have contributed toward making Afghanistan the second most corrupt country in the world. We're going to rely on the United Nations and some of the United Nations partnering organizations and some of the groups with credible records in Afghanistan. Absent that, I just see the United States continuing to be a contributing warlord in a situation of ongoing relentless war.
Kathy Kelly is our guest. We're talking about Afghanistan and what appears, or at least is described in the media, as a shift in U.S. strategy. Again, as John had mentioned initially and over time, the U.S. has said that there must be an Afghan-led, Afghan-owned process, a negotiating process, whatever that actually means. But now the U.S. is proposing direct talks with the Taliban. Kathy, Trump, the candidate in 2016, seemed to be skeptical about why the U.S. was continuing the war effort in Afghanistan. Of course, politicians come and go. We've had three presidents now in the Afghan war since this iteration of the war, the 2001 iteration, has continued. So maybe political leaders in Washington are not as significant as the institutional powers. But again, I just want to get your opinion. Do you sense a difference in approach from Trump, the president, as opposed, say, to Obama?
No, I mean, I think generals come and go, and continually there's been a new general saying, oh, well, now it's going to turn a corner, now it's going to be different, now we'll have a surge, now we'll send people back. I don't really see that there's a significant difference in terms of how this affects average, ordinary people living in Afghanistan, except that the life gets harder and harder no matter who is in charge in the United States. And part of that is because of drought, which is just another card of bad luck, it seems to me, that's handed to people in Afghanistan, but also because they haven't been able to rehabilitate their agricultural infrastructure. They haven't been able to overcome the problems caused by a failed narco state. And so as the water table is lowering, as more and more people are flocking to the cities and the refugee populations in squalid camps are soaring, and as happens when there's chaos, more and more corruption can take place because people are desperate and they make decisions based often on desperation. It doesn't seem terribly relevant, I don't think, to people in Afghanistan, how a given U.S. president decides to try to, you know, use Afghanistan for political advantage.
And Kathy, would the Taliban, given the fact that they've increased their hold on significant parts of the country, up until now, at least what we hear, and you will know more than we do because you're closer to the situation, it's often been reported, at least, that the Taliban would consider a negotiated end of the war as long as foreign troops left. One, is that still their position? And two, the foreign troops, of course, even though it has the imprimatur of NATO, is really America. Is America, do you think, willing to leave as part of any settlement?
Well, right now, the United States has free rent for 9 major bases across the country. And as long as it's there, again, major weapon and military supply companies can continue to profit. It seems unlikely to me that the United States would pull out entirely. And certainly that is what the Taliban has been saying. I suppose we might also ask, what would the Taliban need to do to continue guaranteeing its profits from the sale of opium? And is there some way that the United States is instrumental in that? And that's speculation on my part, but I do think that there are some other aspects to negotiating a maintenance of the status quo that's been very profitable to numerous groups, including the Taliban.
I wanted to ask also, Kathy, if the current Afghan government is strong enough to even conduct negotiations like this, if they were to come to the table. You know, Ashraf Ghani had such a very difficult election against Abdullah, who I think now is the finance minister or vice president, something like that. It escapes me at the moment. But anyway, it was a very contentious election. It was deemed to be an honest election, but it was very difficult between the two of them. And as such, there are two separate political camps now among Afghans who support the government and democratic elections. So do you think Ashraf Ghani is strong enough to be able to represent all the Afghan people in negotiations like this?
Well, I don't think there's any question of Ashraf Ghani representing all the Afghan people. It's a deeply divided society. And again, I want to stress that the warlords have a great deal of power over their own constituencies and, you know, can sometimes just sideline Ashraf Ghani or ignore things that the Afghan government wants to dictate. The Afghan government does have many people on the payroll working for the Afghan National Army, for Afghan local police, for Afghan security forces that come in different stripes, and for the sort of the intelligence agency. But there's tremendous corruption within those entities as well. And I don't think you could say that the Afghan government has successfully dealt with that corruption. In fact, that's one of the major contentions of the Special Inspector General on Afghan Reconstruction, John Sopko. The governing security forces are often compromised and infiltrated, or figuring out ways to bilk the United States for money for security, which goes in many, many different directions, mm-hmm. but doesn't really provide much along the lines of security. So I don't see Ashraf Ghani as being a very strong leader. I think that, you know, they may be able to turn at times to India and to China, which are regionally closer neighbors, and talk about possible collaboration and projects for the future. And one would hope that that collaboration would go better than collaboration with the United States, which has signaled one failed project after another. I think very sadly, for many people within Afghanistan, the opportunity for a better future is believed to be outside of the country. And so people still try to collect money and, you know, get enough to give one person in the family a ticket out. But then again, people are forced back to Afghanistan regularly by countries like Germany that round Afghans up and say, sorry, you know, you don't belong here. You go back to your country. It's really quite safe. And of course, it's not. I go back to the idea that reparations should be paid for the suffering caused.
That was the voice of Kathy Kelly. She joined us from Syracuse, New York. She's the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill usually helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Today, we're joined from Ottawa, not by Bill Ayers, but by Joel Westheimer. He is a full professor and university research chair in democracy and education at the University of Ottawa, specializing in citizen education. His latest book is What Kind of Citizen? Educating Our Children for the Common Good, and you can read more of his work at www.joelwestheimer.org. Joel, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
I have to say, you have one of the most interesting specialties that I've ever heard. You are an expert in patriotism and civic education in schools and how those are inherently politicized things.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little about that?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you find it as interesting as I do, especially in these troubling times. It's for about 20 years now, I've been looking at what schools do to teach kids to be, you know, what we might call in the broadest terms, good citizens. And that can mean anything from people who feel like kids should learn to be good neighbors and good people, not to litter, you know, to show up to work on time, to pay their taxes, to the ways schools might teach kids how social change happens, to look at social movements and the importance of attending to protests and writing your congresspeople and so forth. And then I became especially interested. I'm from New York originally. I'm living in Ottawa, Canada now. But I was in New York during 9/11. And I actually watched as the towers crumbled. And I became very interested after that in the idea of what schools teach about patriotism and what kind of ideologies and politics underlie those visions of patriotism. And I've just never looked back, and I've been just fascinated with this stuff ever since.
We've spoken a couple of times on this show about patriotism and the extremes of patriotism. We spoke not too long ago about patriotism at sporting events, for example, where now we have gigantic flags on the football field, for example, and the color guard comes out for the national anthem, and then there's a flyover of F-18s, and everybody's cheering and chanting USA, USA. I've always believed that that was a dangerous thing, that it's beyond patriotism, it's nationalism, and it has a tendency to get out of hand. What has your research found?
Well, so first of all, the you know, that kind of patriotism is, of course, what troubles so many of us. And I've done quite a bit of research across the United States, and what we found is that that is the most common idea and conception of patriotism taught in schools, right? So especially after 9/11, you know, before 9/11, there were a large number of states, a majority, I think, that had recite the pledge laws on the books, that school kids were supposed to recite the pledge every day or every week. But no one paid any attention to them. Some schools did, some schools didn't. It wasn't enforced. But following 9/11, there was this immediate resurgence of patriotic fervor, and we saw American flags popping up everywhere. And that kind of patriotism, as you are saying, is a dangerous kind of patriotism. And we saw more and more schools subscribing to that sort of unquestioning, unthinking kind of patriotism. Now, when I started this research, you know, patriotism to me was kind of a dirty word. Like, I just didn't see any redeeming qualities in being patriotic. But I have to say, I had that view challenged, and a lot of the stories that I tell in, this was my previous book called Pledging Allegiance, The Politics of Patriotism in America's Classrooms, and a lot of the issues that come out in there, and in fact, Bill Ayers has a chapter in that book, really reveal the ways that people see the potential for a more healthy kind of patriotism when you're not looking at this kind of indoctrination and rah-rah, U.S. is better than everyone. And in fact, look, the origins of patriotism, all the symbols of patriotism that we think of, the pledge, you know, the Emma Lazarus inscription on the Statue of Liberty, America the Beautiful, all of these things were written by progressives. Started by progressives, and many of them were socialist, in fact. And the idea was that we need to get kids to think, you know, in more contemporary terms, beyond their iPhones, that they're a part of something bigger than themselves. And that's the good part of this idea of belonging to something. The bad part, of course, is when belonging to something means that everyone who doesn't belong is made to seem less than good or less worthy of our attention and our compassion.
This is the problem I have with the issue of patriotism. I'm looking again at the famous quote from Samuel Johnson, April 7th, 1775. Patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel, meaning people wrap themselves in the flag in order to, you know, conceal or mislead people. about what's really at stake. But here's the problem. When we sing the song, "This Land Is Our Land," it's made for you and me, and we listen to Woody Guthrie sing it, or the progressives, the leftists who wrote the songs, and of course some of the verses are missing. But nonetheless, patriotism to me doesn't mean simply the love of the Gulf waters or, you know, the big trees in Northern California. It really means affixing oneself to a particular state. And the state has an agenda which takes the sense of community and sense of belonging and sense of loyalty for its own agenda. And that at the moment of crises, patriotism, like after 9/11, I was also in Lower Manhattan at the time. It takes where you know, most of the country hated George W. Bush, and after September 11th, his popularity ratings went to 90%, and there was, you know, that became the sort of context for the invasion of Iraq, which had nothing to do with September 11th. Like these patriotic trainings and impulses, this pledge of loyalty and fidelity to a flag, it seems to me ultimately to always end up in a bad way, because it's really not pledging allegiance to the beauty of the country, its natural beauty, but to the state apparatus. Anyway, what's your take?
Absolutely. And for the most part, our research revealed exactly what you're saying, that in schools, the vast majority of school programs that took up patriotism did it in that mindless, you know, what I delineate, I sort of separate authoritarian patriotism from a more democratic kind of patriotism. And I can say what I mean by that, but mostly schools adopted an authoritarian form of patriotism, which means if you sat in a classroom and observed the lessons going on about patriotism, if you just change them to different national symbols, different, you know, key words, it would be indistinguishable from a lesson in patriotism in China or North Korea or, you know, Indonesia or anywhere, in any authoritarian regime. And that's obviously a very dangerous form of patriotism. But that said, there were school programs, particular teachers usually, who, following 9/11, took up the issues as a teachable moment to teach critical thinking. So while there was 90% approval rate, or upwards of 95% really, approval of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, they embraced also people who were dissenting from it and had students read articles and statements from people who didn't agree, and then they had students discuss those things. And it's there where I think lies the potential. So there's that famous quote, "Patriotism is the last refuge of scoundrels." There's another one that I'm sure many listeners are familiar with, the C.K. Chesterton quote, saying my country right or wrong is like saying my mother drunk or sober, right? You remember that one?
And I don't actually, but it's great.
What's interesting about that is, you know, you say, yeah, that's like so stupid to say my country right or wrong. You know, you wouldn't want your mother to be drunk. But in some ways, when you think about it, like my mother drunk or sober is true, right? She's still our mother. We might get her into rehab. We might take away her alcohol. We might fight to make sure she straightens up. But we still love her because she's our mother. And so if there's any way to capture a sense of you know, identity to our country, only because, look, that's where we vote, that's where we pay taxes, that it's our collective responsibility to make sure our country is sober and not drunk, or in this case is peace loving and not warlike.
But I hear you on that. But I'm gonna push back a little bit, just for the sake of pushing back, I guess. But we have a situation like, when I was a teenager during the Vietnam War, people would say, "Love it or leave it," and that meant it's not your mother; it's like the government that's sending B-52 bombers and dropping bombs on Vietnamese villages, and that was the test. Like, we were considered, and maybe we were, unpatriotic, because patriotism actually, you know, some people try to make the argument that you're making, you know, patriotism could be like telling your country to do the right thing. Telling your country, stop bombing the people in Vietnam. Like, that was like what at that time, a liberal no longer means anything. But at that time, progressivism and liberalism tried to take patriotism in that sense. But that was But then when the country is in fact attacked, like it happened on 9/11, when it wasn't simply the aggressor as it was in Vietnam, this reflex really got the entire country to line up behind the odious George W. Bush. And I just don't know if we can overcome it with the what you're suggesting, which I think is a very admirable point that you're making, to try to look at things in a different way. Anyway, yeah. 40 seconds left. You get the last word.
Well, I wish we could disagree more. Unfortunately, I agree with you. I think the left's project of reclaiming a notion of patriotism to be one where we fight to improve our country has failed. And patriotism is generally associated with a gung-ho, rah-rah, obnoxious and dangerous form of nationalism. But at least what I do want to make clear is that there are teachers in schools all across the country, not many of them compared to the general teaching force, but there are some important teachers doing really important work under the banner of patriotism or social justice education towards a better United States. And of course, you know, with our current situation with Trump and other right-wing governments around the world, this notion of critical thinking and the idea that a democratic kind of patriotism is one that constantly critically examines what the country is doing has never been more important.
I really hear, John, I really hear Joel Westheimer on that. These educators who are doing this, they're going out on the limb. It's not easy. It's much easier to go along, but to go into the classroom and teach a different way of looking at things, including on this question. It takes a lot of guts, but perhaps there's no issue that's more important.
That's right. Well, you were listening to Dr. Joel Westheimer. He is a full professor and university research chair in democracy and education at the University of Ottawa, specializing in citizen education. His latest book is What Kind of Citizen? Educating Our Children for the Common Good. And you can read more about his work at www.joelwestheimer.org. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear.